Welcome to Your Artificial Friends. It's Andy Chandler here, joined by Sam Farmer, Josh Fligger, and Larry Morgan on assignment. But today's episode, I want to get to, it's your first job. Now, we talked about some of Sam's first writing jobs, but no, I want to know about when you had the grit paper. Do they have grit around here? Did we talk about grit before?
We talked a little bit about grit, about the sort of the penny saver.
Yeah. It was like a kid's thing where you deliver it, and I don't know. But it might have been a Midwestern thing. But anyway, want to thank you before we get into this. So many people listening to this thing and checking it out, thousands and thousands of listens to it. And for everybody that goes on iTunes or Audio Boom and listens to this and puts in a review or tells a friend about it or shares it on Twitter or retweets it or shares it on Facebook, means a lot to us because we're kind of feeling our way in the dark in this whole thing. I'm guessing that I'm talking to you, full disclosure, over the weekend, and this is probably going to hit the airwaves when the radio station goes off the airwaves. Plan was it's probably going to be the middle of the week. But that's the transition that's happening, and pretty soon, hopefully, picking up with a daily version of this. But you were the one that actually threw this out, so maybe I'll let you start with it. But you weren't always an award-winning sports writer at the Los Angeles Times. When was your first paying gig?
My first paying job was in fifth grade, if you can believe it. I was working for Stacy's Corners gas station in Boulder, Colorado.
11 years old.
Yeah, 11 years old, spending all my money on candy at the place. And I was fired and told to go home and practice sweeping. I've often wondered about that. Why would you fire a kid who spends all his money on candy at your place?
At your place.
I think I was a willing willing employee. I would have done anything. I wasn't a very good sweeper, okay. But
did you then go home and practice sweeping?
No, I resented that. I resented that, but then I did go home and I was a paper boy for the Daily Camera in Boulder.
The Daily what?
Daily Camera.
Daily Camera.
Yeah, the Daily Camera, which is the Boulder newspaper, and I delivered the paper and. I wasn't very good at that. I was not very accurate. And I remember
accurate in throwing the newspaper.
Yeah, I was a little haphazard in throwing it. And I remember somebody called me at home. Now how
told you to practice sweeping
home number? How they would have my home number? I don't know, but they called me at home and told me that the paper had landed in the gutter and water had it was soaked. And I said, well, this is my last week on the job, so you won't have me to kick around anymore.
How long did you do that? How long
Oh, I probably did delivered papers for a few months. I mean, it felt like a few years, but I remember having to get up really early in the morning.
Right.
I remember when I first got a job at the Mercury News covering the Raiders, my brother called me, and he said, you're the third family employee to work for the Mercury News in San Jose. Because we lived in San Jose for a while. I said, third person in the family. He said, yeah, well, I delivered the paper. And he said, Dad would get up and drive me around and sometimes deliver it when I couldn't wake up. So my dad was a unpaid employee of the Mercury News as well. But, yeah, I did that. I was a moving man.
Moving man.
Yeah, I would meet the long haul drivers at a house, or I'd load up a house onto the truck.
Okay.
For Mayflower.
And really?
Yeah, I did that. That was backbreaking work.
Oh, I bet.
And that was they'd pay in cash, and it was $10 an hour, which was a lot.
Right.
At the time.
Yeah. So, this is late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, this would be probably mid 80s.
Mid 80s.
Mid 80s. Yeah, and. And so I did that. And then I told you about my restaurant work.
When you were a busboy?
I was a busboy. Shitty busboy? Waiter. Yeah, I was the world's worst busboy. And then I was even worse as a waiter at the Hamburger Hamlet in Pasadena.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, I kind of learned early on that
I used to like their little tiny hamburgers, those little...
Oh, like kind of slider
yeah.
things? Yeah. Yeah, well, did I tell you about this? Did we talk about this in an earlier episode?
Well, you talked about, not about the Hamlet. Oh, you talked about the other place where you would go and you would wait for people to thank you for bringing them silverware and stuff.
Well, Hamburger Hamlet was a two-week training. You know, you went through a training period where they had to invest all this time in you. And basically, you were a apprentice waiter. And so you had to learn the entire menu. So you knew that a number 19 had diced onions, not chopped onions, etc.
Right.
And then had to take a written test.
In Hamburger Hamlet, for people that don't know, I wasn't here then, but I've only been here 20 years, but it used to be more established than it is now. I mean,
yeah.
Now I think there's the one, if it's still there, on way out, like Doheny and Sunset. There was one right there.
Yeah.
And then the one in, is there still one
there
in Pasadena?
There was one in Pasadena. There was probably five or six.
There was one in Hollywood, right there at Hollywood and Highland.
Yeah.
And of course it has the, it was featured in The Graduate. They went on a date.
Oh,
it's Dustin Hoffman goes on a date and he comes back with a Hamburger Hamlet bag.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't realize that. Well, it's, it was good. It was sort of a high end burger place. And, so I finally, you know, lost my, I took the test. I was a full-fledged Hamburger Hamlet waiter. And my first night, I was assigned to work. It was a Lakers-Celtics finals game. And it was 1987. It was the game that Magic...
So Larry Bird and Magic.
It was the game that Magic hit the junior skyhook. They came back in that game. Well, I was incensed that they'd had the temerity to make me work on the night when the Lakers and Celtics were playing, even though I was absolutely the bottom man on the totem pole.
Right.
And so I'm working my first night and I'm slammed. I'm in the weeds. I had one table. She had asked for water, and the wait station was in between this part, one dining room and the bar. And so I was watching the game. And the Lakers, I was really grumpy in the first half because the Lakers were behind. Lakers start to come back. I'm getting a little more excited. She asks again for water. I tell her to hold on. I'm watching the
game. One hot minute.
So I'm watching the game. The Lakers comes back. She demands water. I go to the table, and I said, I'll get you your water. But I'm done with this job. So I go back to the wait station. I take off my apron, set it down, go sit at the bar.
I had no idea you were Sam Farmer. It was such a hothead.
Yeah, well, I figured Lakers. So this is, you know, The seeds of sports writing were planted here. And so I went and sat at the bar, and as groups of waiters and waitresses came through to check out the new guy who had just quit sitting at the bar. The Lakers, they took over my table. The Lakers won. I quit. And I went and talked to the boss after the game. Everybody was excited. And they rehired me after a stern talking to, which was actually the worst decision they ever made.
And how long did you last after that?
I lasted pretty much until August. This was
probably late June. 3 months?
It was late June, and I lasted to August. And then I went to Washington, D.C., because I knew I was going to... My senior year of college, I was going to D.C. for a semester. But something we touched on, you know, we were talking in an earlier episode about strange interviews. Well, when I went to D.C., I went and worked for the George Michael Sports Machine, if you remember this.
Not the George Michael from Wham.
No, no, different George Michael, WRC-TV, which is the NBC affiliate in Washington. And I was an intern at the Sports Machine. So I would chart games. I'd watch games. And I parlayed that into an internship at a place called American News Bureau in Washington, D.C. And they'd send me all over D.C. as sort of a production assistant or a field producer. And I'd go and just get sound.
Okay.
And they said, we will send you to the White House. You'll get one trip to the White House in this internship.
Wow.
And yeah, and we don't know if
part of the press pool at the White House.
It was right, and it was Ronald Reagan was president. I don't know if you'll get to see the president, but you'll get one day in the White House. And it was basically this news bureau that if you are a small town, you know, you have a small affiliate in Texas, but something's going on the Hill that relates to your viewership, we will do the story and put a little mic flag on like we're from your station, and we'll freelance the story for you.
Okay.
So they were constantly working for stations all around the country.
Right.
And one day they said, this is your day to go to the White House. And it was James Burnley was hired as the Secretary of Transportation.
That was the news.
He was in North Carolina. If I remember, he was from North Carolina. And I was to go and... it was just going to be a photo op. We weren't going to get sound or anything. Or it was going to be pooled. So I got to go to the White House, and there I am in the White House press room. And, I saw some of the people that I recognized. It wasn't, Chris Wallace wasn't there, but Sam Donaldson and
his
Chris
eyebrows.
Wallace were sort of battling at that time. And, if you remember, this is the time when Reagan, there were a lot of complaints that he wasn't answering questions. They'd crank up the helicopter as he's walking out on the South Lawn. And I can't hear you. I can't hear you.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, James Burnley was being sworn in.
This is what year?
This would be 1987.
87. So we're talking Iran-Contras.
This would be sort of right in the wake of that.
Okay,
this was Al Gore was running for president. It was... The Supreme Court. What was the big?
Clarence Thomas.
No, it wasn't Clarence Thomas. It was Bork.
Oh right,
Bork was running. Anyway, Bork confirmation hearings and a lot of stuff going on in Washington at the time. So it's the swearing in is going to be in the Roosevelt Room, which is not too far from the press room. It's a small room, but it's going to be pooled, so you don't get to go in there. Well, I just followed the cameraman and acted like I was part of the pool. Suddenly, I'm in the Roosevelt Room, in this fairly small room. I mean, it's like our living room,
right?
Which is modest, and there are maybe five rows of chairs. And I'm standing in the back with the cameras. And James Burnley's family is there, in the family and friends in the chairs. And in walks Ronald Reagan and James Burnley. And he does the swearing in. And then Reagan leaves out one door, and it's Burnley and his family and me. And I stick around, and then I leave the room with Burnley's family. And now I'm walking the halls of the White House, you know, an interloper, acting like a member of Burnley's family.
So nobody stops me.
Nobody stops me. I just acted like I pretended like I belong. So we go into another room. I've got a coat and tie on. And I probably don't look like a reporter. I'm a young guy. I'm a college senior.
Right. You're a page as far as they know.
Yes, exactly. We go into another room, and they're handing out champagne. So I grab a glass of champagne. Now I'm in the room with James Burnley's family and drinking champagne and toasting the new Secretary of Transportation. And I say to him, Mr. Burnley, Sam Farmer from American News Bureau. Would you mind answering a few questions in the turnaround there? And he said, yeah, no problem. So somehow I got from there to outside at the turnaround, and on the it's like a little carport kind of thing, right, that you see in front of the press room.
A portico
kind of thing.
And you got the only exclusive.
And I'm okay, yeah, but I mean, secretary.
I don't know, but still.
So I'm thinking, what the hell am I going to ask this guy? I don't even know. You know, I really hadn't done my homework on what I'd ask the Secretary of Transportation. And there were lots of cameras lined up, but no reporters. So he comes out, makes a beeline for me. I grab the microphone. And I froze. And all the cameras now come off the tripods and surround me.
Oh, this is great.
And all I could think of was, tell me about the trains. Secretary of Transportation, tell me about trains. So he had some canned answer about trains. And all I saw was his mouth moving in my microphone there, and I was thinking, what am I going to ask him for a follow-up? And I just said, thank you very much. And that was my day at the White House. Yeah, so I bluffed my way into the Roosevelt room, and then had nothing once I got that far.
Fake it till you make it. I love it. Oh, God.
What about you?
When you brought up the paper route, you took me back to when my brother actually had the paper route when he was, I guess he was 12 when he got it, and he had it for like 4 years. So maybe a little longer than that, 12, 6 years. And I helped him out every now and then. Like, I remember stuffing the Sunday inserts, because there was a huge advertising insert that would come in, you know, many of the papers. So this was the Indianapolis Star. And I remember stuffing those in. You know, they would come on Saturday evening. And then Sunday morning, the papers would come. You'd open them up, stuff each one, and then stack those. And he had, it was a pretty big route. I mean, there were like 120 people around our neighborhood who got the paper. So we even had this big wagon. Did you have those things? It was it was made out of pipe, and it was, you know, like four, it was like a basket where it had, you know, two going up this way and two going up this way.
Oh, okay.
And so there was just a pipe that went up, and you could place the papers inside this wagon, like three or four columns of it, and just take that thing around and deliver them, because there's no way that
you could do
an adolescent kid could do this, right? Mm-hmm. Even, you know, you have the bag with the front and the back is stuffed. On those biggest days, it would be me getting up and going with him when I got a little older, you know, on some of the Sundays and delivering papers.
Sundays
early in the morning. They were horrible. But for the most part, I was the one who went and did the collecting. I would go out and, you know, on Wednesday and Thursday, go around and say, you know, collect. Mom, Dad's paper boy. And, you know, they give me the money. And
you were hoping for a tip?
Or you know, I rarely, I couldn't get anybody to pay on time. I had, like, you know, no muscle whatsoever. I was just this sad-looking 9-10-year-old kid. But when you were talking about it, some of those things came back to me. Like, I remember the wire that was around the bundles of paper when it would come. And you had this thing that looked like a huge washer, like a 2-inch wide washer, and it had little notches on it where you would put that down over the wire and twist it, and it would pop the wire and open them. They went towards the end, I guess, they switched to
plastic.
The plastic, you know, things. But I remember those wires and popping those. And the God, I haven't thought about that in so long. I remember also going down to pay the bill. I remember walking down to pay the bill down on Main Street in Greenwood, Indiana, and walking back, it's like a mile or so, and walking back and stopping at the gas station next door and getting crappy food out of the vending machines, getting a root beer and a Payday or something, and walking back with my brother. But my first paid gig of any import, I sold shoes at JCPenney in the Greenwood Park Mall when I was 16. Huh. for the holidays then. And it was a commission job.
Right.
I mean, the shoes were, it was on commission. I don't think anybody does that anymore.
No.
But, this is mid-80s and 84. And, made enough spending money doing that. It was an easy enough job. But I got to say, man, there's a certain clientele for most things, for home furnishings, generally married couples. For men's suits, it's usually businessmen. Everybody needs shoes. Everybody. The tall, the short, the fat, the thin, the people with disabilities, children. And it was not a job I loved. I mean, because, people would bring their kids in, because snot all over them and, kids sneezing on me and all this kind of stuff. Trying to fit kids for shoes, that was the worst part of the entire thing. But I endured
things
it.
You don't think about.
Yeah.
The Brannick device.
The Brannick. And trying to upsell people on shoes and realizing some people came in and they didn't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out and trying to find them the best bargain you could because we didn't come from money either. But I did not love working retail because you had to kiss everybody's ass.
Right.
You always had to be in a good mood. And especially in a commission job like that, where if they don't buy it from me, if somebody else helps them, and then there's that that feeling of a new customer comes onto the carpet, your little corner of your department, and getting to them before somebody else does, and I'm like, what am I doing? I'm racing somebody to a woman who's going to buy some espadrilles, and I really couldn't give two shits about this. But I worked there. While I was going to school, pretty much, part-time hours, I guess 10, 15 hours a week for most of the year. But then I went off to college, and I came back in between my first and second year of college, and I worked back at JCPenney, but instead of working in the shoe department, I worked in the maintenance department. Because there was a full-time opportunity to work in the maintenance department. So I worked 40 hours a week in the shoe department, or in the maintenance department of JCPenney, building the huge things in the back stock room. Like, I was building the shelves and the conveyor mm-hmm. belts and all that kind of stuff, putting all that kind of stuff together. Didn't ever have to clean a toilet, but I was building stuff. So it was, I didn't mind the work. But then at night, I got a night job of cleaning the floors in supermarkets. You know those big machines that you go in the supermarket late at night?
Right.
They're pushing those.
You're almost driving it.
Yeah.
It's a big thing, yeah.
That is the shittiest work you can imagine. It's nasty chemicals. I mean, you're basically throwing down ammonia to strip these floors and get this wax up into a goop, and then you're scraping that up. Those machines do a good chunk of the work, but a lot of it you're down on your hands and knees, and you're scraping with a scraper to get gum and crap up. And then they have the buffers that are natural gas powered, and taking those up and down the aisles and doing all that stuff. And I was smoking cigarettes at the time, and that was not a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah.
Working 40 hours a week during the day and almost 40 hours a week at night.
Wow.
5 days a week. And I would come home and, somebody would wake me up from a nap in between. Or hey, it's time to go to your night job. And I'd just wake up swinging. I hated it. I hated it. And I remember one time, There was an earthquake in Indianapolis.
Huh.
I felt two earthquakes before I ever moved out to California. And this is before fracking. So this is they're on the New Madrid fault there. Spelled New Madrid, but we're Hicks, so we say Madrid. But it comes up from like Memphis and up through, you know, up right. toward Chicago, kind of through Indiana there. And I remember being woken up, in between my day job and my night job one time, but like, who's shaking the bed? And I looked around, and I was like, okay, so who's messing with me? And my mom came in and told me, did you feel that? I'm like, yeah, who was that? It was an earthquake, I think. And I was just always wow. out of sorts and didn't know whether to shit or go sailing right. on any given moment. It was the worst. And I remember it was after my sophomore year. I went back and I did it again a second summer. And of all things, I hear Q95 was the classic rock station in Indianapolis, still is. And they were playing, this was 87, 1987. And they're playing that summer a track every hour from John Mellencamp's new album, Lonesome Jubilee. And I was taking a cigarette break, and I was smoking a cigarette, and I hear this song play over the radio, first time I'd heard it. But it said, the lyrics were, Jackson was a good kid. He had 4 years of college and a bachelor's degree. Started work when he was 21, got fed up and quit when he was 43. He said, my whole life I've done what I'm supposed to do. Now I'd like to maybe do something for myself. And just as soon as I figure out what that is, you bet your life I'm going to give it hell. I want the real life. I want to live the real life. And I realized in that moment, because all of my personal epiphanies up to that moment came from John Mellencamp. I realized that I was going to school for mechanical engineering. And I hated it. I hated it. Thermodynamics classes, we called it thermogoddamics. It was so hard. And questions that, I didn't even want the answer to. Word problems, the pressure in the vessel is 800 torr, the vessel's 1 liter, the temperature is 690 Kelvin. What floor did the elevator stop on? I'm like, I don't know. I'll call the operator outside and say, will you go check the thing and let me, I don't care. It was like years later, I'd hear Kurt Vonnegut was interviewed and somebody asked him about, were you a good student? And he said, yeah, mostly. And they said, well, what were you not a good student in? He said, math. I hated math. He goes, those problems? Train A leaves the station at 2 o'clock traveling 30 miles an hour. Train B leaves the station at 4 o'clock traveling 60 miles an hour. Right. At what point will train B overtake train A? You know what the answer is? I'll blow my goddamn brains out. That's the answer. I don't care. I don't want to know. And I was starting to feel like that about math, and physics. And all. I just wasn't loving it. And so I took off from my day job at JCPenney the next day and drove up to Lafayette and changed my major to communications that day. So I credit the bleary, logy, half-conscious state that working two full-time jobs put me in for changing the course of my life. But then I went back up, and I was already working a little bit at the newspaper, and started working more at the newspaper then. The Exponent was the name of it, and it was a big deal. It was like a 20,000 daily circulation paper.
Yeah,
which by as, most
yeah that's a significant.
It's a good sized city, right?
Yeah,
20,000 every day, and so worked up there and ended up being. The managing editor finally, and then they fired me. And I was out at, we talked about this before, I was out at, for my 21st birthday, and I'm out with friends, and we just go to this bar where this local radio station happened to be doing a remote, and one of my desk editors from the paper was there. He was a part-time news guy, and the news director said, Dean, do you know anybody that would want your job after you're gone? And he points at me, and she goes, oh, would you be interested? I'm like, and I end up doing it, for a couple of years. But while I'm there, my first full-time radio job paid $10,700 a year. which is even in 1989 is poverty, right?
Yeah, that would be. I mean, I was living in poverty, and I'd probably making double that at a small newspaper.
Yeah, it wasn't kind. It was bad.
10,000. Wow.
Ooh, yeah, it was really bad.
Oh, 10,9.
10,7.
Oh, 10,7. Well, it's not 10. a year.
So, yeah, it was really, really bad. But before I even got to full time, I worked selling cell phones, mobile phones.
Oh, yeah, the bricks.
This is 1989, 90, right, when cell phones are the size of a shoebox.
Right.
You know? And they're massive. And 8 people had them.
Right.
So I was in on the ground floor of that, for all the good it did me. But then when I moved to Indianapolis, moved there with my fiance at the time, and I was working doing the overnights at X103, and I wasn't making near enough money doing that. And so I found a job at the Indianapolis Steel Factory, the steel mill. And my job was basically the janitor at the steel mill, cleaning up stuff, like degreasing heavy machinery.
Right.
With this vat of chemicals that basically had a label on it that says, "Don't even look at me." You know, don't even touch. And I'm just in there with my bare hands, you know, degreasing this, a whole bunch of machines and stuff. Worst. And I come home just black. I mean, my jeans and everything. I didn't even have coveralls to wear. I'm just in there doing it. But you did what you had to do to get by and survive. My other gig before that was cleaning out our landlord. My roommate and I had a landlord like a year before that, who owned our house, the building, a house that we had that was two apartments that he divided it into. And then next door, he owned the business, the little office there. Right. And there were like 4 offices in there, including he was a bookkeeper, I think. And there was a dentist in there. And he said, "Hey, I'll knock off half your rent every month if you go twice a week and clean out the dentist's office." So my roommate and I are like, "All right, yeah, we can make that happen." But when you've got to go, you remember at 9 o'clock on Sunday night that you've got to go next door and clean out this dentist's office and put your hands in, you know what kind you spit out. You know, there's all kinds of medical waste and blood and this spit and all this nasty stuff that I'm emptying and putting all of that
in and throwing life.
There's got to be a better life doing something. But those were my first jobs trying to get going in radio. And then I got a radio job, and things evened out a little bit after that. But I remember when I moved out to L.A., first thing I did, I didn't have a job. There was no job waiting for me. Just moved out here saying, "I'm going to see if something happens.
Yeah.
And if it does, great. If it doesn't, at least I can go home and say, all right, you know, I gave it a try." My first job as a temp was working. They placed me with the Michael Milken Cancer Institute, the Prostate Cancer Institute, CapCure was the name of it, down in Santa Monica. So I drove from my crappy little apartment in Koreatown down to Santa Monica. My job was to spend 8 hours a day updating their roles, their database. So I would call, a typical phone call would go something like this. "Hi, is this Mrs. Wilkins?" "Hi, Mrs. Wilkins. This is Andy Chanley from CapCure in Santa Monica, California. How are you?" "Good, good. I was just calling to update the information on Walter. Is the address still 459 Main Street?" "He passed away. I am so sorry for your loss. I am really sorry. I will update our information, Mrs. Wilkins, and We won't be calling to bother you again. Again, I'm very, very sorry for your loss. 8 hours of that.
Oh, my goodness.
8 hours a day of that. I did it for like 2 weeks until I finally got tapes out to radio stations, and somebody called me back, and I got a job at Y107. But it was pretty awful.
Oh, I will say, my brother, my middle brother, Tom, used to be the guy who got us jobs. He was an expert at this, at getting us jobs when we were in college. And, you know, you remember you had to go through the one ads and circle jobs. And,
right.
And he would play a little fast and loose with the facts to promote us for jobs. I remember my friend Matt was looking through the one ads, couldn't find anything. And then my brother looked at him and circled this one and circled this one and circled this one.
Said, yes, I'm a qualified lathe operator.
Yeah, he says. Matt looks at him and he says, apartment manager. And Matt said, Tom, it says you have to have 5 years experience. Tom said, Matt, you live in an apartment.
You're managing that.
So one time he took a group of my buddies down to UPS to do a UPS jobs, which are good jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of backbreaking, but good jobs.
Sure.
Loading trucks. And one of my pals, Scott, who wasn't real super sharp on the upstroke there, they got this tour of the UPS plant. And it was, you know, 20 people touring the UPS plant. And after about a half hour, they finished the tour, and Scott had, anybody have any questions? Scott had a question. Yeah, why do all the boxes have ups written on them? And then they're filling out the applications, and Scott's stuck on page one of the application. Finally, you know, everybody finishes theirs, and Scott's still on, you know, stuck on page one. And
hey, Lenny, I found a mouse. Can I keep it?
He said, Scott, what's going on? He said, I don't know how old my mom is. And the guy said, well, what are you talking about? I don't remember that. And he said, right here, spouse's date of birth. So Tom had his work cut out for him with that one.
It reminds me of a friend of mine. His folks were in law enforcement, his stepdad was. And one of his cousins, or his uncles, went to apply for this is up in Central Valley. He goes to apply for a job with the police department, and you have to fill out this application, and they're asking him questions. It's like, do you drink alcohol? He says, yes. Have you ever been inebriated? Yes. How many times would you say you've been inebriated? He's like, total? Yes. 3,000? Oh, no. So there you go, kids. From small acorns grow mighty oaks. We got to leave it there because Josh is waiting outside to join us on the next one. On the next episode, we're going to continue talking about one of Josh's early jobs, and it has something to do with the Elks Club. Something tells me I'm going to enjoy it. But thank you for tuning in to Your Artificial Friends, the podcast on iTunes and Audio Boom. Subscribe to the feed if you haven't already, and reach out to us individually. Andy_Chanley@twitter.com.
At LA Times Farmer.
And join us next time on Your Artificial Friends.